conceive of wanting to marry me. I was sincere. I had for many years accustomed myself to the prospect of a solitary life, to be poor, ugly, and, moreover, intelligent condemns one in our society to a dark and disillusioned life, a condition one ought to accept at an early age. To beauty, all is forgiven, even vulgarity. Intelligence no longer seems an adequate compensation for things, some sort of balancing of the scales offered by nature to those less favored among her children. No, it is a superfluous plaything that exists only to enhance the value of the jewel. As for ugliness, it is guilty from the start. And I was doomed by my tragic destiny to suffer all the more, for I was hardly stupid. Rene, he replied, with as much gravity as he could muster, showing himself to be more loquacious during the long disquisition to come than he would ever be again. Rene, I don't want my wife to be one of those giddy young things who run wild and have no more brain than a sparrow beneath their pretty face. I want a woman who's loyal, a good wife, a good mother, and a good housekeeper. I want a calm and steady companion who'll stay by my side and support me. In exchange, you can expect me to be a serious worker, a calm man at home, and a tender husband at the right moment. I'm not a bad sort, and I'll do my best. And he did. Small and dry like the stump of an elm tree, he had nevertheless a pleasant face, and usually wore a smile. He did not drink, smoke, chew tobacco, or gamble. At home, when work was done, he'd watch television, browse through fishing magazines, or play cards with his friends from the factory. He was very sociable, and often invited people over. On Sundays, he went fishing. As for me, I looked after the housekeeping, because he didn't like the idea of me doing it for other people. He was not lacking in intelligence, although his particular intelligence was not of the sort that an industrious society values. While his skills were confined to manual work, he displayed a talent that did not stem solely from mere mechanical aptitude. And, however uneducated he might be, he approached everything with a spirit of ingeniousness, something which, where small tasks are concerned, distinguishes the artists from the mere laborers, and, in conversation, shows that knowledge is not everything. Having been resigned from an early age to the prospect of the life of a nun, I felt, therefore, that it was benign indeed of the heavens to have placed between my young bride's hands a companion with such agreeable manners, and who, while not an intellectual, was no less clever for it. I might have ended up with the likes of Grelier. Bernard Grelier is one of the rare souls at 7 Rue de Grenelle, in whose presence I have no fear of betraying myself. Whether I say to him, "War and Peace is the staging of a determinist vision of history," or, "You do well to oil the hinges in the garbage room," he will not find that one is any more significant than the other. It even seems miraculous that the latter phrase manages to fire him into action. How can one do something one does not understand? No doubt, this type of proposition does not require any rational processing, and like those stimuli that move in a loop through our bone marrow and set off a reflex without calling on the brain, perhaps the summons to apply oil is merely of a mechanical nature and sets in motion a reaction in one's limbs without inviting the mind to participate. Bernard Grelier is the husband of Violette Grelier, who is the housekeeper for the Artons. She began working for them 30 years ago as a simple maid, and she rose through the ranks as they in turn became wealthier. And once she was a housekeeper, she found herself reigning over a laughable kingdom whose subjects were the cleaning lady, Manuela, the part-time butler, an Englishman, and the factotum, her husband. She is as scornful of the lower classes as are her high and mighty upper-class employers. All day long she jabbers like a magpie, busily rushing here and there, acting important, reprimanding her menial subalterns, as if this were Versailles in better days, and exhausting Manuela with pontificating speeches about the love of a job well done and the decline of good manners. "She hasn't read Marx," said Manuela to me one day. The pertinence of this remark, uttered by a Portuguese woman who is in no way well-versed in the study of philosophy, is striking. No, Violette Grelier has certainly not read any Marx, for the simple reason that he does not appear on any lists of cleaning products for rich people's silverware. She has paid the price for this oversight by inheriting a daily routine, punctuated with endless catalogues vaunting the qualities of starch and linen dustcloths. I, therefore, had been well married. To my husband, moreover, I had very quickly confessed my great sin.
Profound thought number two. The cat here on earth, modern totem, and intermittently decorative. In any case, this is true at our place. If you want to understand my family, all you have to do is look at the cats. Our two cats are fat windbags who eat designer kibble and have no interesting interaction with human beings. They drag themselves from one sofa to the next and leave their fur everywhere. And no one seems to have grasped that they have no affection for any of us. The only purpose of cats is that they constitute mobile decorative objects, a concept which I find intellectually interesting, but unfortunately our cats have such drooping bellies that this does not apply to them. My mother, who has read all of Balzac and quotes Flaubert at every dinner, is living proof every day of how education is a raving fraud. All you need to do is watch her with the cats. She's vaguely aware of their decorative potential, and yet she insists on talking to them as if they were people, which she would never do with a lamp or an Etruscan statue. It would seem that children believe for a fairly long time that anything that moves has a soul and is endowed with intention. My mother is no longer a child, but she apparently has not managed to conceive that Constitution and Parliament possess no more understanding than the vacuum cleaner. I concede that the difference between the vacuum cleaner and the cats is that a cat can experience pain and pleasure. But does that mean it has a greater ability to communicate with humans? Not at all. That should simply incite us to take special precautions with them as we would with very fragile objects. When I hear my mother say, "Constitution is both a very proud and very sensitive little cat," when in fact said cat is sprawled on the sofa because she's eaten too much, it really makes me want to laugh. But if you think about the hypothesis that a cat's purpose is to act as a modern totem, a sort of emblematic incarnation, protector of the home, reflecting well upon its owners, then everything becomes clear. My mother makes the cats into what she wishes we were, and which we absolutely are not. You won't find anyone less proud and sensitive than the three aforementioned members of the Jos family. Papa, Maman, and Colombe. They are utterly spineless and anesthetized, emptied of all emotion. In short, in my opinion, the cat is a modern totem. Say what you want. Do what you will with all those fine speeches on evolution, civilization, and a ton of other shun words. Mankind has not progressed very far from its origins. People still believe they're not here by chance, and that there are gods, kindly for the most part, who are watching over their fate.
Chapter 4. Refusing the Fight. I have read so many books, and yet, like most autodidacts, I am never quite sure of what I have gained from them. There are days when I feel I have been able to grasp all there is to know in one single gaze, as if invisible branches suddenly spring out of nowhere, weaving together all the disparate strands of my reading, and then suddenly the meaning escapes. The essence evaporates, and no matter how often I reread the same lines, they seem to flee ever further with each subsequent reading. And I see myself as some mad old fool who thinks her stomach is full because she's been attentively reading the menu. Apparently, this combination of ability and blindness is a symptom exclusive to the autodidact. Deprived of the steady guiding hand that any good education provides, the autodidact possesses nonetheless the gift of freedom and conciseness of thought, where official discourse would put up barriers and prohibit adventure. This morning, as it happens, I am standing, puzzled, in the kitchen, with a little book set down before me. I am in the midst of one of those moments where the folly of my solitary undertaking takes hold of me, and on the verge of giving up, I fear I have finally found my master. His name is Husserl, a name not often given to pets or to brands of chocolate, for the simple reason that it evokes something grave, daunting, and vaguely Prussian. But that is of little consolation. I believe that my fate has taught me, better than anyone, to resist the negative influences of world thought. Let me explain. If thus far you have imagined that the ugliness of aging and conciergely widowhood have made a pitiful wretch of me, resigned to the lowliness of her fate, then you are truly lacking in imagination. I have withdrawn, to be sure, and refused to fight, but within the safety of my own mind, there is no challenge I cannot accept. I may be indigent in name, position, and appearance, but in my own mind, I am an unrivaled goddess. Thus, Edmund Husserl, and I have concluded that this is a name fit for vacuum cleaner bags, has been threatening the stability of my private Mount Olympus. All right, all right, all right, I say, taking a deep breath. To every problem there is a solution, no? I glance at the cat, waiting for a sign of encouragement. The ungrateful wretch does not respond. He has just devoured a monstrous slice of rillette, and henceforth, imbued with great kindliness, has colonized the armchair. All right, all right, all right, I say again like an idiot, and, puzzled, I stare at the ridiculous little book. Cartesian Meditations. Introduction to Phenomenology. It quickly becomes clear, given both the title and the first few pages, that it is not possible to read Husserl, a phenomenological philosopher, if one has not already read Descartes and Kant. And yet one discovers with equal alacrity that even a solid mastery of Descartes and Kant will not, for all that, open the doors to transcendental phenomenology. This is a pity, because I have great admiration for Kant, for a number of reasons. His ideas are an admirable concentration of genius, rigor, and madness, and however Spartan the prose might be, I have had no difficulty in penetrating the meaning. Kantian texts are great works of literature, and I would like to prove this by demonstrating their ability to pass with flying colors the cherry plum test. The cherry plum test is extraordinary for its disarming clarity. It derives its power from a universal observation. When man bites into the fruit, at last he understands. What does he understand? everything. He understands how the human species, given only to survival, slowly matured and arrived one fine day at an intuition of pleasure. The vanity of all the artificial appetites that divert one from one's initial aspiration toward the virtues of simple and sublime things. The pointlessness of discourse. The slow and terrible degradation of multiple worlds from which no one can escape. And, in spite of all that, the wonderful sweetness of the senses when they conspire to teach mankind pleasure, and the terrifying beauty of art. The cherry plum test is held in my kitchen. I place the fruit and the book on the formica table, and as I pick up the former to taste it, I also start on the latter. If each resists the powerful onslaught of the other, if the cherry plum fails to make me doubt the text, and if the text is unable to spoil the fruit, then I know that I am in the presence of a worthwhile and, why not say it, exceptional undertaking. For there are very few works that have not dissolved, proven both ridiculous and complacent, into the extraordinary succulence of the little golden plums. I am truly up the creek, I say to Leo, because my skills where Kant is concerned do not amount to a hill of beans when I contemplate the abyss of phenomenology. I am left with no alternative. I will have to enlist the help of the library and attempt to unearth an introduction to the matter at hand. Ordinarily, I am very wary of such glosses or shortcuts which tend to place the reader in the iron grip of scholastic thought. But the situation is far too grave for me to allow myself the indulgence of equivocation. Phenomenology is beyond my reach, and that I cannot bear.
Profound thought number 3. The strong ones among humans do nothing. They talk and talk again. It's one of my profound thoughts, but it came from another profound thought. It was one of Papa's guests at the dinner party yesterday who said, "Those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. Those who can't teach, teach the teachers. And those who can't teach the teachers, go into politics." Everyone seemed to find this very inspiring, but for the wrong reasons. "That's so true," said Colombe, who is an expert at fake self-criticism. She's one of those who think that knowledge is power and forgiveness. "If I know that I belong to a self-satisfied elite who are sacrificing the common good through an excess of arrogance, this liberates me from criticism, and I come out with twice the prestige." Papa also tends to think like this, although he's less of an idiot than my sister. He still believes that something known as duty exists. And although in my opinion that's just pure fancy, it protects him from the cynic's debility. Let me explain. Nobody is a greater schoolgirl in spirit than a cynic. Cynics cannot relinquish the rubbish they were taught as children. They hold tight to the belief that the word has meaning, and when things go wrong for them, they consequently adopt the inverse attitude. "Life's a whore. I don't believe in anything anymore, and I'll wallow in that idea until it makes me sick," is the very credo of the innocent who hasn't been able to get his way. That's my sister all cut out. She may be a student at the École Normale, but she still believes in Santa Claus. Not because she has a good heart, but because she is totally childish. She started giggling like an idiot when Papa's colleague came out with his fancy phrase, as if to say, "I'm an expert on the mise en abîme." And that confirmed what I've been thinking for a long time. Colombe is a walking disaster. As for me, I think that his sentence is a bona fide profound thought, precisely because it isn't true, or at least not entirely true. It doesn't mean what you think it does at the outset. If people could climb higher in the social hierarchy in proportion to their incompetence, I guarantee the world would not go round the way it does. But that's not even the problem. What his sentence means isn't that incompetent people have found their place in the sun, but that nothing is harder or more unfair than human reality. Humans live in a world where it's words and not deeds that have power, where the ultimate skill is mastery of language. This is a terrible thing, because basically we are primates who've been programmed to eat, sleep, reproduce, conquer, and make our territory safe. And the ones who are most gifted at that, the most animal types among us, always get screwed by the others, the fine talkers, despite these latter being incapable of defending their own garden, or bringing a rabbit home for dinner, or procreating properly. Humans live in a world where the weak are dominant. This is a terrible insult to our animal nature, a sort of perversion, or a deep contradiction.
Chapter 5. In a Sorry State. After 1 month of frenetic reading, I come to the conclusion, with immense relief, that phenomenology is a fraud. In the same way that cathedrals have always aroused in me the sensation of extreme lightheadedness one often feels in the presence of man-made tributes to the glory of something that does not exist, phenomenology has tested to the extreme my ability to believe that so much intelligence could have gone to serve so futile an undertaking. As this is already the month of November, there are no cherry plums available. At times like this, therefore, 11 months a year in actual fact, I have to make do with dark chocolate, 70%. But I know in advance the outcome of the test. Had I but the leisure to bite into the standard meter, I would slap myself noisily on the thighs while reading, and such delightful chapters as Uncovering the Final Sense of Science by Becoming Immersed in Science Qua Pneumatic Phenomenon, or The Problems Constituting the Transcendental Ego, might even cause me to die of laughter, a blow straight to the heart as I sit slumped in my plush armchair with plum juice or thin driblets of chocolate oozing from the corners of my mouth. When you set out to deal with phenomenology, you have to be aware of the fact that it boils down to two questions. What is the nature of human consciousness? What do we know of the world? Let's start with the first question. For millennia now, by way of know thyself to I think, therefore I am, mankind has been rambling on about the ridiculous human prerogative that is our consciousness of our own existence, and above all the ability of this consciousness to make itself its own object. When something itches, a man scratches and is aware that he is scratching. If you ask him, what are you doing? He'll reply, I'm scratching myself. If you push your questioning a bit further, are you aware that you are conscious of the fact that you are scratching yourself? He will again reply, yes. Thus, ad infinitum to as many are you aware and conscious questions as you wish. Does this, however, leave man with any less of an itch to know that he is scratching and is aware of it? Can reflective consciousness have a beneficial influence on the order of the itching? Nay, not in the slightest. Knowing that it itches, and being conscious of the fact that one is conscious of knowing it, has absolutely no effect on the fact of the itching. As an added handicap, one must endure the lucidity that results from this wretched condition, and I would wager 10 pounds of cherry plums that such lucidity merely serves to exacerbate an unpleasant condition, which my cat, for example, can eliminate with a quick flick or two of his rear paw. But it seems so extraordinary to us. No other animal is capable of this, and in this way we escape our own animal nature, that as human beings, we are able to know that we are in the process of scratching ourselves. This preeminence of human consciousness seems to many to be the manifestation of something divine that is able to escape the cold determinism in us to which all physical things are subject. All of phenomenology is founded on this certainty. Our reflective consciousness, the sign of our ontological dignity, is the only entity we have that is worth studying, for it saves us from biological determinism. No one seems aware of the fact that since we are animals subject to the cold determinism of physical things, all of the foregoing is null and void. Chapter 6. Homespun Cowls. Which brings us to the second question. What do we know of the world? Idealists like Kant have an answer to this question. What do they answer? They answer, not a great deal. Transcendental idealism holds that we can know only that which appears to our consciousness. That semi-divine entity that rescues us from our animal self. What we know of the world is what our consciousness can say about it because of what it has perceived and nothing else. Let us take an example at random. A sweet cat by the name of Leo. Why? Because I find it easier with a cat. And let me ask you, how can you be certain that it really is a cat? And likewise, how can you even know what a cat is? A healthy reply would consist in emphasizing the fact that your perception of the animal, complemented by a few conceptual and linguistic mechanisms, has enabled you to constitute your knowledge. But the response of the transcendental idealist would be to illustrate how impossible it is to know whether what we perceive and conceive of as a cat, if that which appears to our consciousness as a cat, is actually true to what the cat is in its deepest being. It may well be that my cat, at present I perceive him as an obese quadruped with quivering whiskers, and I have filed him away in my mind in a drawer labeled cat, is, in actual fact, and in his very essence, a blob of green sticky stuff that does not meow. My senses, however, have been fashioned in such a way that this is not apparent to me, and the revolting blob of green sticky stuff, deceiving both my disgust and my earnest trust, is masquerading before my consciousness beneath the appearance of a silky and gluttonous house pet. So much for Kantian idealism. What we know of the world is only the idea that our consciousness forms of it. But there is an even more depressing theory than that one, a theory that offers a prospect even more terrifying than that of innocently caressing a lump of green drool, or dropping our toast every morning into a pustular abyss we had mistaken for a toaster. There is the idealism of Edmund Husserl, which, as far as I'm concerned, now signifies designer label homespun cowls for wayward monks sidetracked by some obscure schism in the Baptist church. According to Husserl's theory, all that exists is the perception of the cat. And the cat itself? Well, we can just do without it. Bye-bye, kitty. Who needs a cat? What cat? Henceforth, philosophy will claim the right to wallow exclusively in the wickedness of pure mind. The world is an inaccessible reality, and any effort to try to know it is futile. What do we know of the world? Nothing. As all knowledge is merely reflective consciousness, exploring its own self, the world, therefore, can merrily go to the devil. This is phenomenology. The science of that which appears to our consciousness. How does a phenomenologist spend his day? He gets up, fully conscious as he takes his shower, that he is merely soaping a body whose existence has no foundation. Then he wolfs down a few slices of toast and jam that have been nihilized, slips on some clothes that are the equivalent of an empty set of parentheses, heads for his office, and then snatches up a cat. It matters little to our phenomenologist whether the cat exists or does not exist, or even what the cat is in its very essence. The indemonstrable does not interest him. What cannot be denied, however, is that a cat appeared to his consciousness. And it is this act of appearing that is of concern to our good fellow. And what is more, an act of appearing that is quite complex. The fact that one can explain in detail the way in which one's consciousness perceives a thing whose very existence is a matter of indifference is simply extraordinary. Did you know that our consciousness does not perceive things right off the bat, but performs a complicated series of operations of synthesis, which, by means of successive profiling, introduce to our senses objects as diverse as, for example, a cat, a broom, or a fly swatter, and God knows isn't that useful. Have you ever wondered why it is that you can observe your cat and know at the same time what he looks like from the front, behind, above, and below, even though at the present moment you are perceiving him only from the front? It must be that your consciousness, without your even realizing it, has been synthesizing multiple perceptions of your cat from every possible angle and has ended up creating this integral image of the cat that your sight, at that moment, could never give you. And the same is true for the fly swatter, which you will only ever perceive from one direction, even though you can visualize it in its entirety in your mind, and, oh miracle, you know perfectly well, without even turning it over, how it is made on the other side. You will agree that such knowledge is quite useful. We can't imagine Manuela using a fly swatter without immediately rallying the knowledge that she has of the various stages of profiling necessary to her perception. Moreover, you can't imagine Manuela using a fly swatter for the simple reason that there are never any flies in rich people's apartments. Neither flies, nor pox, nor bad smells, nor family secrets. In rich people's apartments, everything is clean, smooth, healthy, and consequently safe from the tyranny of fly swatters and public opprobrium. But enough of phenomenology. It is nothing more than the solitary, endless monologue of consciousness, a hardcore autism that no real cat would ever importune. Chapter 7. In the Confederate South. "What are you reading?" asks Manuela, who has just arrived breathless from her Lady de Broglie's, feeling consumptive after preparing the evening's dinner party. She had just accepted delivery of 7 jars of Petrosian caviar and was breathing like Darth Vader. "An anthology of folk poems," I say, closing the Husserl chapter forever. Manuela is in a good mood today, that I can see. She eagerly unpacks a little hamper filled with almond sponge fingers that are still set in the frilly white paper in which they were baked, then sits down and smooths the tablecloth carefully with the flat of her hand, the prelude to a statement that will send her into transports of delight. I set out the cups, join her at the table, and wait. "Madame de Broglie is not pleased with her truffles," she begins. "Oh, really?" I ask politely. "They do not smell," continues Manuela crossly, as if she holds this shortcoming to be an enormous personal affront. We indulge in this information for all it's worth, and I savor the vision of Bernadette de Broglie in her kitchen, looking haggard and disheveled, and doing her utmost to spray a potion of cep and chanterelle juice onto the offending roots in the ridiculous, insane hope that they might condescend to give off some faint odor evocative of the forest. And Neptune peed on Monsieur Sanice's leg, continues Manuela. The poor beast must have been holding it in for hours, and when Monsieur Badoise finally got out the leash, the dog couldn't wait, and in the entrance he went on Sanice's trouser leg. Neptune, a cocker spaniel, belongs to the owners of the third floor, right-hand side apartment. The second and third floors are the only ones divided into two apartments of 2,000 square feet each. On the first floor, you have the De Broglie's. On the fourth, the Arton. On the fifth, the Jus. And on the sixth, the Palière. On the second floor are the Meurice and the Rosens. On the third, the Sanice and the Badoise. Neptune belongs to the Badoise, or more precisely, to Mademoiselle Badoise, who is studying for her law degree in Assas, and who organizes soirees with other Cocker Spaniel owners studying for law degrees in Assas. I am very fond of Neptune. Yes, we appreciate each other a great deal, no doubt because of that state of grace that is attained when one's feelings are immediately accessible to another creature's. Neptune can sense that I love him. His multiple desires are perfectly clear to me. What charms me about the whole business is that he stubbornly insists on remaining a dog, whereas his mistress would like to make a gentleman of him. When he goes out into the courtyard, he runs to the very, very end of his leash and stares covetously at the puddles of muddy water idling before him. His mistress has only to give one jerk to his yoke for him to lower his hindquarters down onto the ground, and with no further ado, he will set to licking his attributes. The sight of Athena, the Maurice's ridiculous whippet, causes Neptune to stick his tongue out like a lubricious satyr and pant in anticipation, his head filled with phantasms. What is particularly amusing about Cocker Spaniels is their swaying gait when they are in a playful mood. It's as if they had tiny little springs screwed to their paws that cause them to bounce upward, but gently, without jolting. This also affects their paws and ears like the rolling of a ship. So Cocker Spaniels, like jaunty little vessels plying dry land, lend a nautical touch to the urban landscape. Utterly enchanting. Ultimately, however, Neptune is a greedy glutton who'll do anything for a scrap of turnip or a crust of stale bread. When his mistress leads him past the garbage can room, he pulls frenetically in the direction of said room, tongue lolling, tail wagging madly. Diane Badoise despairs of such behavior. To her distinguished soul, it seems that one's dog should be like the young ladies of antebellum high society in Savannah in the Confederate South, who could scarcely find a husband unless they feigned to have no appetite whatsoever. But instead, Neptune carries on as if he were some famished Yankee.
Journal of the Movement of the World, number 2. Bacon for the Cocker Spaniel. In our building, there are two dogs. The Whippet, belonging to the Meurices, who looks like a skeleton covered over with beige leather hide. And a ginger Cocker Spaniel, who belongs to Diane Badoise, an anorexic blonde woman who wears Burberry raincoats, and who is the daughter of a very la-di-da lawyer. The Whippet is called Athena, and the Cocker, Neptune. Just in case you don't yet understand what sort of place I live in, you won't find any Fidos or Rovers in our place. Anyway, yesterday, in the hallway, the two dogs met, and I was fortunate to witness a very interesting sort of ballet. I won't dwell on the dogs, who sniffed each other's bottoms. I don't know if Neptune smells bad, but Athena took a leap backward, while Neptune looked as if he were sniffing a bouquet of roses with a huge juicy steak in the middle. No, what was interesting was the two human beings at the end of each leash. Because in town, it is the dogs who have their masters on a leash, though no one seems to have caught on to the fact. If you have voluntarily saddled yourself with a dog that you'll have to walk twice a day, come rain, wind, or snow, that is as good as having put a leash around your own neck. Anyway, Diane Badoise and Anne-Hélène Maurice, same mold 25 years apart, met in the hallway, each at the end of her leash. What a muddle when this happens. They're as clumsy as if they had webbed fingers and feet, because they're incapable of doing the only truly practical thing in cases like this. Acknowledge what is going on in order to prevent it. But because they act as if they believed they were walking two distinguished stuffed animals utterly devoid of any inappropriate impulses, they cannot bleat at their dogs to stop sniffing their asses or licking their little balls. So here's what happened. Diane Badoise came out of the elevator with Neptune, and Anne-Hélène Maurice was waiting right outside with Athena. They virtually threw their dogs one on top of the other, and obviously it sent Neptune utterly crazy. Here you come nicely trotting out of the elevator, only to find your nose right up against Athena's derriere. That's not something that happens every day. For ages now, Colombe has been ranting on to us about kairos, a Greek concept that means roughly the right moment, something at which Napoleon apparently excelled. Naturally, my sister is an expert on military strategy. Anyway, kairos is the intuition of the moment, something like that. Well, I can tell you that Neptune had his kairos right in front of his nose, and he didn't mess around. He made like a hussar in the old style and climbed right on top. "Oh my God!" shrieked Anne-Hélène Maurice, as if she herself were victim of this outrage. "Oh no!" exclaimed Diane Badoise, as if all the shame were hers. Whereas I'd bet you a chocolate truffle that it would never have occurred to her to climb onto Athena's rear end. And they both began pulling at their dogs' leashes, but there was a problem. And that's what evolved into an interesting movement. In fact, Diane should have pulled upward and the other lady downward, which would have released the two dogs, but instead of that, they each pulled sideways. And as it's very narrow in front of the elevator cage, they very quickly ran into an obstacle. One of them the elevator grill, the other the wall on the left, and as a result, Neptune, who had lost his balance with the first tug, suddenly got a surge of energy and clung all the more solidly to Athena, who was howling and rolling her eyes with fright. At that point, the humans changed strategy by trying to drag their dogs away to a larger space so that they could repeat the maneuver more comfortably. But the matter was getting urgent. Everyone knows there's a point at which dogs get stuck. So they really stepped on it, shouting simultaneously, "Oh my God! Oh my God!" pulling on their leashes as if their very virtue was at stake. But in her haste, Diane Badoise slipped and twisted her ankle. And this was the moment of the interesting movement. Her ankle twisted toward the outside, and at the same time, her entire body swerved in the same direction, except for her ponytail, which went the opposite way. It was magnificent, I assure you. It was like something by Bacon. There's been a framed Bacon in my parents' bathroom forever. A picture of someone on the potty, in fact. And in good Bacon style, you know, sort of tortured and not very appetizing. I have always thought that it probably had an effect on the serenity of one's actions. But anyway, in my house, we each have our own toilet, so there was no point complaining. But Diane Badoise was completely thrown out of joint when she twisted her ankle, making weird angles with her knees, her arms, and her head. And to top it off, her ponytail sticking out horizontally like that. And I immediately thought of the Bacon in the bathroom. For a very brief moment, she looked like a disjointed rag doll, her body completely contorted, and for a few thousandths of a second, it happened very quickly, but as I am very attentive to the movements of the body these days, I saw it as if in slow motion. Diane Badoise looked like a full-length portrait by Bacon. From that sudden impression, to the consideration that the thing in the bathroom has been there all these years just so now I could fully appreciate her bizarre contortions, there is only a short step. And then, Dian fell onto the dogs, and that solved the problem because Athena, crushed on the ground, managed to wriggle free of Neptune. A complicated little ballet then followed. Anna Len trying to help Dian, and all the while keep her dog at a safe distance from the lubricious monster. And Neptune, completely indifferent to the shouts and pain of his mistress, continued to pull in the direction of his steak à la rose. But at that very moment, Madame Michel came out of her loge, and I grabbed Neptune's leash and dragged him farther away. He was so disappointed, poor mutt. And so he flopped down and started licking his little balls, making a lot of slurping noises, which only added to poor Dian's despair. Madame Michel called an ambulance because Dian's ankle was seriously beginning to look like a watermelon, and then she took Neptune to her place, while Anna Len-Marie stayed with Dian. As for me, I went home and said to myself, okay. A bacon come to life before my very eyes. Does that make it worth it? I decided it didn't. Because not only did Neptune not get his treat, but on top of it, he didn't even get his walk.
Chapter 8. Prophet of the Modern Elite. This morning, while listening to France Inter on the radio, I was surprised to discover that I am not who I thought I was. Until that time, I had ascribed the reasons for my cultural eclecticism to my condition as a proletarian autodidact. As I have already explained, I have spent every moment of my existence that could be spared from work in reading, watching films, and listening to music. But my frenzied devouring of cultural objects seems to me to suffer from a major error of taste, brutally mixing respectable works with others that are far less so. It is most certainly in the domain of reading that my eclecticism is least pronounced, though even there the variety of my interests is most extreme. I have read history, philosophy, economics, sociology, psychology, pedagogy, psychoanalysis, and, of course, above all, literature. While all these have always interested me, literature has been my whole life. My cat, Leo, was baptized thus because of Tolstoy. My previous cat was called Dungo because of Stendhal's Fabrice Dell. The first one was called Karenina because of Anna, but I called her Carrie, for short, for fear of being found out. With the exception of my guilty lapse where Stendhal is concerned, my taste is most definitely partial to pre-1910 Russia. But it flatters my pride to note that the amount of world literature I have devoured is nevertheless considerable, given the fact that I am a country girl who, by ending up head concierge at 7 Rue de Grenelle, has witnessed her career expectations go far beyond what she anticipated. Particularly when you think that such a destiny should surely have doomed her to the eternal worship of Barbara Cartland. I do confess to a guilty indulgence for detective stories, but the ones I read I considered to be true works of literature. I find it especially exasperating when, from time to time, I have to drag myself away from my Connolly or Mankell in order to go and answer the door for Bernard Grelier or Sabine Palliere, whose concerns are hardly shared by the likes of Harry Bosch, the jazz-loving LAPD cop, and all the more so when all they have to say is, how come the garbage smells all the way out into the courtyard? That Bernard Grelier and the heiress of an old Banque de France family could both speak in so colloquial a manner and yet be preoccupied by the same trivial things sheds a new light onto humanity. Where the cinema is concerned, however, my eclecticism is in full flower. I like American blockbusters and art house films. In fact, For a long time, I preferred to watch entertaining British or American films, with the exception of a few serious works that I reserved for my aesthetic sensibilities, since my passionate or empathetic sensibilities were exclusively focused on entertainment. Greenaway fills me with admiration, interests, and yawns, whereas I weep buckets of syrupy tears every time Melly and Mammy climb the stairway at the Butler Mansion after Bonnie Blue dies. As for Blade Runner, it is a masterpiece of high-end escapism. For years, my inevitable conclusion has been that the films of the seventh art are beautiful, powerful, and soporific, and that blockbuster movies are pointless, very moving, and immensely satisfying. Take today, for example. I quiver with impatience at the thought of the treat I have in store. The fruit of exemplary patience, the long-deferred satisfaction of my desire to see once again a film I saw for the first time at Christmas in 1989. Chapter 9, Red October. By Christmas 1989, Lucien was very sick. We did not yet know when his death would come, but we were bound by the certainty of its imminence, bound to the dread inside, bound to each other by these invisible ties. When illness enters a home, not only does it take hold of a body, it also weaves a dark web between hearts, a web where hope is trapped, like a spider's thread drawn ever tighter around our projects, making it impossible to breathe. With each passing day, the illness was overwhelming our life. When I came in from running chores outside, it was like entering a dark cellar where I was constantly cold, with a chill that nothing could remedy, so much so toward the end that when I slept alongside Lucien, it seemed as if his body were sucking up all the heat my body might have managed to purloin elsewhere. His illness was first diagnosed in the spring of 1988. It ate away at him for 17 months and carried him off just before Christmas, 1990. The elder, Madame Maurice, raised money among the inhabitants of the building, and a fine wreath of flowers was delivered to my loge, bound with a ribbon that bore no text. She alone came to the funeral. She was a cold, stiff, pious woman, but there was something sincere about her austere and rather abrupt manners. And when she died, a year after Lucien, I said to myself that she had been a good woman and that I would miss her, although we had scarcely exchanged two words in 15 years. She made her daughter-in-law miserable right up to the end. May she rest in peace. She was a saintly woman, said Manuela, who professes a truly epic hatred for the younger Madame Maurice, by way of a funeral oration. Thus, with the exception of Cornelia Maurice, with her little veils and rosaries, Lucien's illness did not strike anyone as being worthy of interest. To rich people, it must seem that the ordinary little people, perhaps because their lives are more rarefied, deprived of the oxygen of money and savoir-faire, experience human emotions with less intensity and greater indifference. Since we were concierges, it was a given that death for us must be a matter of course, whereas for our privileged neighbors, it carried all the weight of injustice and drama. The death of a concierge leaves a slight indentation on everyday life. Belongs to a biological certainty that has nothing tragic about it. And, for the apartment owners who encountered him every day on the stairs or at the door to our loge, Lucien was a non-entity who was merely returning to a nothingness from which he had never fully emerged. A creature who, because he had lived only half a life, with neither luxury nor artifice, must at the moment of his death have felt no more than half a shudder of revolt. The fact that we might be going through hell, like any other human being, or that our hearts might be filling with rage as Lucien's suffering ravaged our lives, or that we might be slowly going to pieces inside, in the torment of fear and horror that death inspires in everyone, did not cross the mind of anyone on these premises. One morning, 3 weeks before that Christmas, I had just come in from shopping with a bag filled with turnips and lung for the cat, and there was Lucien, dressed and ready to go out. He had even knotted his scarf and stood there waiting for me. After weeks of witnessing my husband's agony as, drained of all strength and enveloped in a terrifying pallor, he would hobble from the bedroom to the kitchen. After weeks of seeing him wear nothing other than a pair of pajamas that looked the very uniform of demise, and now to find him, with his eyes shining and a mischievous expression on his face, the collar of his winter coat turned right up to his peculiarly pink cheeks, I very nearly collapsed. "Lucien!" I exclaimed, and I was about to go to hold him up, sit him down, undress him, and I don't know what else, everything that the illness had taught to me in the way of unfamiliar gestures, which had become of late the only ones I knew how to make. I was about to put my bag down and embrace him, hold him close to me, carry him, all those things once more, when, breathless and feeling a strange flutter of expansion in my heart, I stopped in my tracks. "We'll just make it," said Lucien. "The next show is at one." In the heat of the theater, on the verge of tears, happier than I had ever been, I was holding the faint warmth of his hand for the first time in months. I knew that an unexpected surge of energy had roused him from his bed, given him the strength to get dressed and the urge to go out, the desire for us to share a conjugal pleasure one more time. And I knew, too, that this was the sign that there was not much time left, a state of grace before the end. But that didn't matter to me. I just wanted to make the most of it, of these moments stolen from the burden of illness, moments with his warm hand in mine and a shudder of pleasure going through both of us because, thank heavens, it was a film we could share and delight in equally. I think he died right after that. His body held on for 3 more weeks, but his mind departed at the end of the film, because he knew it was better that way. Because he had said farewell to me in the dark theater. There were no poignant regrets. Because he had found peace this way. He had placed his trust in what we had said to each other without any need for words, while we watched, together, the bright screen where a story was being told. And I accepted it. The Hunt for Red October is the film of our last embrace. For anyone who wants to understand the art of storytelling, this film should suffice. One wonders why universities persist in teaching narrative principles on the basis of prop, grima, or other such punishing curricula, instead of investing in a projection room. Premise, plot, protagonists, adventures, quest, heroes, and other stimulants, all you need is Sean Connery, in the uniform of a Russian submarine officer, and a few well-placed aircraft carriers. As I was saying, this morning on France Inter Radio, I learned that this contamination of my aspiration to high culture by my penchant for lower forms of culture does not necessarily represent the indelible mark of my lowly origins or of my solitary striving for enlightenment, but is rather a contemporary characteristic of the dominant intellectual class. How did I come to know this? From the mouth of a sociologist. And I would have loved to have known, if he himself would have loved to have known, that a concierge in shoal clogs had just made him into a holy icon. As part of a study on the evolution of the cultural practices of intellectuals who had once been immersed in highbrow culture from dawn to dusk, but who were now mainstays of syncretism, in whom the borders between high and low culture were irreversibly blurred, my sociologist described a classics professor who, once upon a time, would have listened to Bach, read Mauriac, and watched arthouse films, but nowadays listened to Handel and M.C. Solar, read Flaubert and John le Carré, went to see Visconti and the latest Die Hard, and ate hamburgers at lunch and sashimi in the evening. How distressing to stumble on a dominant social habitus just when one was convinced of one's own uniqueness in the matter. Distressing, and perhaps even a bit annoying, the fact that in spite of my confinement in a loge that conforms in every way to what is expected, in spite of an isolation that should have protected me from the imperfections of the masses, in spite of those shameful years in my 40s when I was utterly ignorant of the changes in the vast world to which I am confined, the fact that I, René, 54 years old, concierge and autodidact, am witness to the same changes that are animating the present-day elite, little Payer in their exclusive schools who read Marx then go off in gangs to watch Terminator, or little Badoise who study law in Assas and sob into their Kleenex at Notting Hill, is a shock from which I can scarcely recover. And it is patently clear, for those who pay attention to chronology, that I am not the one who is aping these youngsters, but, rather in my eclectic practices, I am well ahead of them. René, prophet of the contemporary elite. And well, why not, I thought, removing the cat's slice of calf's liver from my shopping bag and from beneath that, carefully wrapped in an unmarked sheet of plastic, two little fillets of red mullet, which I intend to marinate, then cook in lemon juice and coriander. And that is when it all started.
Profound thought number 4. Care for plants, for children. There's a cleaning woman who comes to our house 3 hours a day, but it's Mama who looks after the plants. And it's an unbelievable rigmarole. She has 2 watering cans, one for water with fertilizer, one for special soft water, and a spray gun with several settings for targeted squirts, either shower or mist. Every morning she inspects the 20 houseplants in the apartment and administers the appropriate treatment to each one. She murmurs all sorts of stuff to them, oblivious of the outside world. You can say whatever you want to Mama while she's looking after her plants. She'll completely ignore it. For example, I'm going to buy some drugs today and maybe go for an overdose. We'll get you the following answer. The kentia's going yellow at the tips of the leaves. Too much water. Not good at all. With this, we grasp the opening tenets of the paradigm. If you want to ruin your life by not listening to what other people are saying to you, look after houseplants. But that's not all. When Mama is squirting water onto the plants, I can plainly see the hope that fills her. She thinks it's a kind of balm that is going to penetrate the plant and bring it what it needs to prosper. It's the same thing with the fertilizer, which she gives them by means of little sticks in the soil, in the mixture of potting soil, compost, sand, and turf that she has made up specifically for each individual plant at the nursery over at the Porte d'Otille. So, Mama feeds her plants the way she feeds her children. Water and fertilizer for the kentia, green beans and vitamin C for us. That's the heart of the paradigm. Concentrate on the object, convey all the nutritional elements from the outside to the inside, and, as they make their way inside, they will cause the object to grow and prosper.